For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. For this week's In the Moment Arts Update, we bring you three powerful female artists as we welcomed this week Raina Del Cid, Sophia Beattie, and Jamie Lynn. We've also got new poetry this week from Patrick Hicks and a jazz standard from a string quartet that features South Dakotan's own cellist, Carl Henry. It's a remarkable lineup. Let's get started. Raina Del Cid continues to evolve as an artist, and we continue to celebrate her musical journey. She's on tour this summer, but she took time out of her schedule to talk with SDPB's Chris Loffrey, and she shared a glimpse into her creative process.
There is such an art to songwriting. It's not an easy thing. Can you share with us how you go about songwriting?
Well, I think for a lot of people, there's a very specific process. Maybe they write the lyrics first or the chord melody, something like that. But for me, it usually comes all at the same time. There's usually a phrase and a melody that kind of comes into my head, and then I sit down with the guitar, come out with a progression, and usually it's a pretty simple progression, and that's where I take it to Tony, the lead guitar player in my band, who has a more defined musical sensibility than I do, and she usually fleshes it out and orchestrates it a little bit more. And the full band, we have a bass player and an organ player. They kind of bring their own parts to the song, and it becomes a lot more full, 3D. So that's kind of the process. It usually starts with just me and a melody, and then the others kind of fill it out.
You've been to Sioux Falls before, and tell us why Sioux Falls makes a good sense as a location to start your tours.
Well, it's only 4 hours away from us. Kind of the perfect place to kick off a tour. I really love South Dakota. I love driving through South Dakota. I can't say that about every state. Usually after that is Nebraska. And there's a lot of open nothing there. But South Dakota reminds me of home. And I really like it as a starting off point. I like the community in Sioux Falls.
Do you mind if I play the song Suffer?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, now before we play it, this song hit me really hard from a lyrical standpoint, and I'm not really sure why, because, I mean, it's so powerful. As you listen to this song, you could come at it from a couple of different angles. Now, I'm curious if this is a breakup or a goodbye song, and I'm hoping that you can kind of give us some background before we play it.
Yeah, so this is a song, to me, it's a song about jealousy and how it can, it can destroy or eat away at a relationship from the inside. And I don't know that it's a breakup song. It's that moment before people break up, when it's like, are we on our last legs in the relationship?
I know you suffer. You suffer. are tall, the gates are locked, the guards are on the mountaintops, and here inside there's you and me, the other ships upon the sea keep passing by, and they are all you see. Here comes the cloud, the shadow of doubt, you're not satisfied till you wipe them all out. Everything to me. And even in those times when I've had too much wine, I'll never forget that I'm yours and you're mine. So baby, don't suffer. Don't suffer. Baby, don't suffer.
Now, you probably know Patrick Hicks from the weekly podcast Poetry from Studio 47, which airs Fridays on In the Moment during the 11 o'clock hour. And you probably know Patrick Hicks from his gripping Holocaust novel, The Commandant of Lubezeck. And you probably know Patrick Hicks from his various poetry and short story collections, including Adoptable and This London. In other words, if you don't already know Patrick Hicks, consider yourself alerted. He's one of our greats. He joined us to read from his latest collection, The Library of the Mind, New and Selected Poems. Patrick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always wonderful to be back.
Let's start with this new collection.
Sure.
How does a collection like this of new and selected works really come together for you as a poet?
Well, I was really honored when my publisher in Ireland sort of suggested a new and selected because it's one of those watermarks in a writer's career. So I said, yes, you know, I would love to do that. So the question then became the selected poems. Those are easy. I just had to look at the work that I had done and sort of figure out what my greatest hits were, as it were. But then when it came time to sit down and write the new poems, that's when things became kind of problematic for me, quite frankly, because that phrase new, that can mean anything. And my previous collections, they've all orbited around, say, London, or they've orbited around what it means to adopt internationally. But with the moniker of just a new poem, I mean, I was kind of rudderless. I wasn't sure what that would look like.
That's how the rest of us feel every day. Rudderless about write about. Did it take you back to that beginner mind kind of thing? Like, how did you deal with that fact that at this moment you could start anywhere?
Yeah, with that much freedom, it was kind of paralyzing, to be honest with you. So I realized that what I needed to do was to put myself in sort of a pressurized environment. So I went away for like a long weekend, and this isn't very exciting, but I knew that what I did ultimately would yield hopefully some good work. So I just checked myself into a hotel for 3 days. I left my family, I got a hotel room, I brought my laptop and a bunch of paper and some pencils and a pencil sharpener, and I just wrote poetry for 3 solid days. And I would say that of that, you know, maybe 30 to 35% of the poems ended up in the collection itself, and the rest were, shall we say, not up to snuff.
Not yet.
Not
they're,
yet.
They're somewhere.
Yeah.
What was the experience of looking back like as you look at your own work and sort of how are you measuring it? Is it how many times you're asked to read it? Is it how audiences respond? Is it just it meant something to you? Are you
That's
looking
a great
at quality
question.
Of craft? And I
yeah.
really was successful at what I was trying to accomplish right then? Like,
yeah, I really appreciate that question because that's exactly what I had to think about when it came time for, well, the selected poems, and what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So I immediately chose the poems that seem to have resonated with audiences, or I've heard from people that this particular poem meant something to me. So I included those in the collection for sure. But then there are one or two poems that I've put in the collection where, you know, they're there because I like them, because they did something aesthetically for me that I was maybe kind of quietly proud of. You know, I tried something new and it seemed to have worked. And even if it didn't connect with the audience, it was like one of those sort of like marks for me that like you challenged yourself and you sort of met that challenge. So there are a couple of poems like that in here, which I think, you know, I might be the only fan of, but that's okay.
What are some of the formative experiences you have as a poet?
Well, from the very beginning, I get my love of language, and what a gift it was for me that my mother's an immigrant from Northern Ireland. So, you know, she had a stronger accent when I was growing up. This is the 70s. But she gave me the children's books that she knew as a child. So I grew up with, you know, Enid Blyton is a writer that I'm sure no one's really heard of here in the States, but she was a really big British writer. So I was reading these books, which most of them were published in the 1950s. And, of course, it's full of British English. And I was really fascinated by how language influences culture. So that really kickstarted some of my interest in writing itself. And then I guess like so many people, when they start off with wanting to write, you know, a short story seems like a really big undertaking. A novel is an impossibility when you're starting off. But a poem, that seems like something you can tackle and maybe be successful at. And you could put a full day of work into a poem and it might actually be successful. So I started off with poetry just because it seemed like a vehicle that might actually deliver me where I wanted to get to eventually.
Let's take that as an opportunity to segue into a poem.
Sure.
And the one I'm hoping you might read for us first is actually called Words. It's on page 109 of the new collection. And tell me a little bit about where this came from, just writing words about words.
This actually has its genesis with SDPB. Yeah. Kara Hetland had asked me to write a poem, this was years ago, for a project she was working with about healing and words. So she asked me to write a poem. And I was happy with the poem that was used and broadcast on SDPB. But when I came to revisit this particular poem, which is in the new section, but technically maybe isn't new, I changed it around a little bit. So this was just this idea that words are all that we have. I mean, words are the only way that we can communicate. Otherwise, we're stuck in the kingdom of our own imaginations, and words are the only way that we can connect with each other. That I take in breath, and I force air up through my esophagus, and then it goes over my tongue, and then the airwaves travel through, and they hit your ear, and then it goes into your brain. I mean, it's miraculous, really. We take it for granted. But it's the only thing that connects us together. So that's where this came from. So this is words. Words can bind wounds or slit skin. They doze in the skull's honeycomb. They quiver the voice box, twitch the muscled tongue, pulse across the vast space between us, and tap against the door of an ear. Words can be as warm as fresh bread or as flinty as an arrowhead piercing the aorta's wall. Words can build up a child or tear down empires. Words can resurrect the dead. In the silence of the looming last line, that gateway at the bottom of the page, where the end begins and the bullet hole of a period finds its mark, watch how words flutter away like leaves on a river of wind. So I discovered that whether you're writing poetry or fiction or nonfiction, at the core of it, what people really want is a story. We are a species that's driven by story. And that matters to us so much. And as far as we know, we're the only life form in the whole universe that understands story. We can talk about the past. We can talk about the future. And so it really comes down to story. And are you going to tell me a good story? That's what matters, I think. I mean, from the beginning of when we wake up, like say, how'd you sleep? You know, do you have any dreams? I mean, that's an invitation for a story. You come home from work. You know, how was your day? That's an invitation for a story. We watch sports, and that's a story that will unfold on a field or a hockey rink or something.
We have never talked about your process, and I'm wondering if we could do that for a minute.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about how, you know, you mentioned going to a hotel room and spending a long period of time, your laptop. How do you sort of capture those ideas and create new poems?
If you were to see my office, I've intentionally set up my office where I have two desks And they're sort of at an angle like this. And one is where I write fiction, and the other is where I write poetry. And I have a chair, so I can sort of swivel between the two. And the poetry desk has pencils and erasers and the tools you would expect. The fiction and the nonfiction sort of desk has just the computer. So I need to write, I need to type if I'm doing prose. But for the first draft of poetry, I like the organic feeling of a pencil. And I'll spread out a number of blank sheets of paper, because I feel like if I have one blank sheet of paper, I'll fill that, and that's going to be the length of the poem. But if I allow myself to have sort of the like five or six blank sheets of paper, it allows my imagination to unspool itself until it feels like the poem is over. So that's the physical setup. And as far as writing prose is concerned, I'm really regimented in that I write 750 words, and I don't get up from my desk until I've written those 750 words. And sometimes that can take half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. Sometimes it's a bit more like going to the dentist, and it can take several hours. So, you know, some days are better than others. And with the poetry, I don't have a word limit. I just kind of will keep drafting and redrafting, and I'll let it sit for a while, and then I might put the poem away for a couple of weeks and then revisit it. So it's two very different approaches that seem to work for me. And I'm a writer that needs silence. I know other writers need noise, a coffee shop, hustle bustle, and they need music, and I need silence.
Would you read another poem from this book
Sure.
for me? It's on page 112.
Okay.
And it's teaching the history of the Third Reich to ninth graders.
Oh, yes. This poem came about because this actually happened. I was invited to a local high school here in South Dakota to teach the history of the Third Reich, and the days happened to be ninth graders. And this happened only 48 hours or maybe 72 hours after the Unite the Right rally that happened in Charlottesville. While I was teaching the history of the rise of Nazism, I could not help but think of what happened in Charlottesville and the clash of Nazis in our own country. So, teaching the history of the Third Reich to ninth graders after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Because I am a guest speaker, they lean in when I say such words as Untermensch, Aryan, and Shoah. I talk about how the bedrock of democracy was dynamited by jackbooted thugs, how these men raised the gallows of their arms and marched through the streets with brass knuckle and song. I teach them the word Lügenpresse, the lying press, and explain how the National Socialists used this phrase to erase facts with the acid of hate. I talk about the Nuremberg Laws, broken glass, and blood. It happened fast, I say, staring at the American flag. A train, somewhere in the distance, bleats out at a crossing. There is the sound of heavy freight clacking. It is a metronome, or something like the ticking of a bomb. I stare at these ninth graders who are just beginning to author the long pages of their lives. They are 15, as old as Anne Frank happened to be when the door of her attic world was kicked open and all that had once been safely locked outside came pouring in.
When I think of you as an author, that's one of the things that I think is so important to how I see you, is your willingness and your dedication, the depth of your knowledge, the quality of your writing about the Third Reich, about the Holocaust. Because you don't necessarily have an easy connection to it. You are a person who is a key, has in some ways become a keeper of the story.
Yeah.
And more, as time goes on, those will be the only people left.
Yeah.
Be people without direct, a direct impact in a way that we might recognize.
Yeah.
How do you sort of see your role? I think that's incredibly brave, and I see that as an act of service. As a writer, do you see that as an act of service?
I hadn't thought about it in those words exactly, but the more that I've learned about the Holocaust and the more camps that I've gone to, someone asked me recently how many camps I had done research at, and I had to count them up, about 11 camps at this point in time, and I've interviewed a variety of Holocaust survivors, and I've been doing this for long enough that I realize I have built up this archive in my head of certain things that maybe people don't know about. So I've sort of reached a stage with my understanding of the Holocaust that I recognize I'll be lecturing and talking about this for a long time to come, because the information is in my head and it doesn't seem right to just let it sit there. So I find myself writing about it and returning to it. And I have this, maybe it's not a strange idea. Your listeners can judge for themselves, but I feel like stories choose writers and not the other way around. I think story, and I know this sounds abstract and kind of mythical, but I think things happen to writers sometimes without their choosing or by accident that gets them invested in certain things. To give you an obvious example, because my wife and I, we couldn't have biological children, we adopted a little boy, and we knew we wanted to adopt a little boy, and he happens to be from Korea, so now I care very deeply about what happens on the Korean Peninsula. If he was from South America, maybe I wouldn't care about, you know, what happens in Korea quite as much. So this is what I mean by how stories choose writers. And the Holocaust, for whatever reason, was something that came to me at a very young age. And I had a sort of an interest in, well, how could this civilized nation of Germany, how could it pivot so quickly and so rapidly in the course of less than 15 years to do what it did?
Do you have an answer yet? It seems like an unanswerable question in some ways.
It is an unanswerable, yes, it is unanswerable, and yet it's a part of who we are as a species. I mean, it's not that the Germans were monstrous. What they did was monstrous, but it's not like they were separated from the human species in any kind of way. And I think that there's an abiding sort of interest in the Holocaust because it's a warning of what we're capable of doing to each other under the proper sort of circumstances. You know, we have detention camps right now for immigrant children, and they... You know, our country doesn't seem to be too bothered by the fact that they're not being treated well. That worries me. It worries me a lot. It should worry all of us. Shame on us.
Let's talk about children and your son, and you mentioned adoption. And one of my favorite poems in this book from the new section is Eavesdropping on page 127. I want to talk a little bit about the role of an adoptive parent, but maybe first we could have you read that poem.
Eavesdropping. She appears in the kitchen when I'm draining spuds or chopping red onions. She turns a ghostly ear to the conversation I'm having with my son. How is school? What about homework? Tell me the high and low of your day. She, my son's birth mother, that Korean girl who had to let him go, must wonder who loves him now. As I flip a flank of flaky salmon and turn off the bubbling peas, I see her chewing gum next to the fridge. She fidgets, trying to decode the prattle of our words, the puzzle of our tongues. It must be strange for her to watch a middle-aged American place a steaming meal before her boy. As I go back into the kitchen for the peppermill and garlic butter, I brush past her ghost. This teenage girl challenges me to do better. She stands there silently, listening, judging.
What is the community of poets like in South Dakota? How supportive and connected is it?
I got really lucky when I moved to this state because I came here because Augustana offered me a job, which I'm very grateful for. And I started to write and I found these other writers, and it's a really supportive community. And it seems to me that in the last several years, poetry has really flourished in this state in a really wonderful way with what's happening with South Dakota State Poetry Society. We've got the book co-op here in Sioux Falls. And every time we have the South Dakota Festival of Books, it seems like we have more poets. And it's really wonderful, which is one reason why I really enjoy doing poetry from Studio 47, because I can bring these voices that I'm sort of aware of to the larger sort of community of the state. But that's one of the gifts about being a writer. And when I was younger and I wanted to be a writer, the thing I never, ever once thought about is the friendships that you make along the way. And you become friends with these people. And, you know, you get so excited. Like, Jim Reese has a new book coming out in November called Bone Chalk. And I am super excited that his book's coming out because I know how hard he's worked on that. Yeah. And I feel the same with Christine. And Leanne has a new book out right now. And that's wonderful.
What's the response been to Poetry from Studio 47, which you can download as a podcast today?
Yeah. I have had a blast making this, as has my producer, Pete Folliard, who is a professor at Augustana in the music department. I definitely want to thank Pete. I mean, with your show and the response has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed doing it, and it's been an awful lot of fun for me to essentially do what I do at Augustana, but to pare it down to a 5-minute segment and then to get it out in the airwaves. And I'm being very intentional with the poems that I'm choosing because I want to choose poems that tell a story. And if I'm doing my job properly, I really want listeners, if they've pulled up in their driveway, to not want to get out of their car until the episode is over. So I'm choosing poems that I know tell really good stories.
And it's not just South Dakota poets, but you've talked with many South Dakota, or you've shared the work of many South Dakota poets. So there's something about it that feels broad, but it feels like we matter. You know, it's this big poetry conversation, and here we are in it, which is another program would not feel central to that. So that's one of the things that I've learned so much, and I've enjoyed it so much at the same time.
I've had a lot of fun with that, and I'm very intentional. I try to have at least one South Dakota poet. You know, we got four episodes a month, so I always try in my mind to have one South Dakota poet every single month, and then I'll have a poet maybe from somewhere else in the United States or somewhere else in the world or from some other community in the United States that maybe I feel like maybe we should hear what their voice is.
Yeah, and some of those poems are just the ones that you'll carry with you for a lifetime,
really.
This last Friday, you talked about poetry out loud and read the work of the original poems from South Dakota student poets. That was a real treat.
It was a treat for me.
Yeah.
I was so happy to do that. I'm so happy the idea came to me to read original poems from South Dakota poets. And I'm so grateful that they allowed me to do that. And I one reason I did it is I thought to myself, well, if I was 17 or 18 and I had a poem that was read on the air, I would like that.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal.
All right, let's. I want you to pick a poem from this new collection to read for us now. Poet's choice.
I think I might close out with, because I think this will probably be the last poem. I think maybe I'll do Harry Potter World, which is one of the final poems in this. My son loves Harry Potter, like most other 10-year-olds. So we took him to Universal Studios in Florida, and he loved it. You know, as you only could. I mean, he reads the books, and suddenly he's surrounded by Gringotts and all of these kind of things. But because I'm a space nerd and I love the space race and I'm fascinated by rocketry and all that kind of thing, we went to the Kennedy Space Center because I was going to infuse some educational experience into that. So we did Harry Potter World, and the next day we did the Kennedy Space Center. So this is a poem that sort of puts these two things together. Harry Potter World, Orlando, Florida. We took you because Hogwarts is the capital of your imagination. All those posters in your room, all those wands, how you sneak up on me and yell, "Stupefy!" when I make poached eggs for breakfast. And so we boarded a Muggle plane to visit a place where young wizards exist and you could drink chilled pumpkin juice. An expensive trip, but it was worth it to see your eyes grow as large as two rememberalls when we entered Ollivander's and Honeydukes. As we rode through a Quidditch match and plummeted into the vaults of Gringotts, you focused on the pulsing world before us. I looked to the sides and considered the sorcery of hydraulics and dry ice. The next day, when we visited the Kennedy Space Center, it was my turn to gawk while you carried a wand made of old vine and dragonheart string. We strolled beneath a Saturn V, that mighty broomstick which lifted us higher than any Nimbus 2000 or Firebolt ever could. As we talked about the Philosopher's Stone, we considered the moon rocks encased in glass. And then, together, we placed our fingers on a triangular slice of basalt which once rested in the Taurus Littrow Valley. In that moment, touching a splinter of moon, I wanted to travel into your mind to see the floating candles of your ideas, the magical world that bubbled inside the great hall of your skull. You said nothing as you rubbed the moon, but I felt you lifting away from me, already launching yourself into adulthood, already climbing mile by nautical mile beyond the place where you began. I saw the powerful flame of years carry you up, up, up until you were out of sight, just a voice pulsing out faint messages from the world that you'll explore as a man. No longer a boy who reaches for my hand and asks, glad for my company, what should we see next, Daddy?
Sophia Beattie is well known in the Rapid City music scene. She's been one of the most requested artists for a Moment in Sound performance. You've got to feature Sophia Beattie, you told us, and we're glad you did. She played from our South Dakota Public Broadcasting Black Hills studio.
But Do you feel me? Can you hear what I say? Can you not see how I got this way? I throw my dreams under my own spell. You see, our crew, we don't play those games. What we do is hidden under a name. There's a lot that we've been through, can't you tell? We hold the breaths underwater. Some of us find living is harder, but we are the same. Full of the same pain, and nobody knows how death truly feels unless you've heard it scream with your very own ears. There's nothing on our jackets. Our identity's anonymous. If you've ever been broken, stolen, torn in open, misused, abused, then you can join the club. Come on inside. If you've ever fallen, trusted, needed, wanted, but no one can, that one will never around. Stay by up and join the club. Ba 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 da 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 da. It's not enough to hear what I say. Let me show you how I get through the day while they stare and make fun. I turn and make my escape. If you want in, then don't you dare stay. You're here to find strength in words that they say. Depression's eating your heart, but you'll be okay. We hold our breaths underwater. Some of us fight, living is harder, but we are the same. Full of the same pain, and nobody knows how death truly feels unless you've heard it scream with your very own ears. There's nothing on a jacket. Our identity's anonymous. If you've ever been broken, stolen, torn in open, misused, abused, then you can join the club. Come on inside. If you've ever fallen, trusted, needed, wanted, but no one can, that one will never be found. They stay by up and join the club. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Sweep-ba-ba-ba-da-ee-ay. Sweep-ba-ee-ay-ay-ay-ay.
Do you have someone you'd like to hear on the program? Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Now, Jamie Lynn is one of South Dakota's premier musicians, both as a solo artist and as a collaborator. Her projects have explored the history of homesteading, the life of Billie Holiday, jazz, rock, folk, and Americana. She joined us for Moment in Sound and talked with SDPB's Jackie Hendry about where songs come from.
The stars are pregnant with your cause. There's us for them to gaze upon. Your screen is tattered to my moth. Conveniently, the light is on. So look up, rewrite all the wrong. The stars are here to urge you on. Be sure of anything you do. I came here 'cause I wanted to. So look up and rewrite all the wrong. The stars are here to urge you on. And be sure of anything you do. I came here 'cause I wanted to. Drone of interstate, but the silence of the sky abates. The scent of pine smoke and a vine takes us to another time. So look up and rewrite all the wrong. The stars are here to urge you on. And be sure of anything you do. Came here 'cause I wanted to.
Tell us a little bit about what inspired that song.
It's kind of embarrassing because it's like maybe one of the poppiest, like kind of, I don't know. Yeah, it's just I don't write a lot of pop music or relationship songs, but it's really just like a summer in the country song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've got plenty of experience in the country kind
of
thing.
I guess
you're an East River gal, right?
That's right. Yep. I grew up on a farm in northeastern South Dakota. So just kind of being out in the pastures and out in nature in the summer.
Yeah. Do you find, I know you play and you also write, do you find you're most inspired in those more natural settings, or
absolutely.
Where do you find your most inspiration?
Yeah, a lot of my a lot of my past albums have been like explicitly, you know, just like, exclusively, that's the right word, inspired by the landscape and yeah, the nature and the animals and that are around out in this part of the country. And yeah, what I've been writing lately has been more towards people and my life, which is new for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think has driven that shift artistically?
I think it's just, I'm ready to. So for the last 10 years, I've been traveling constantly across, usually in state, sometimes out of state. And so, you know, I think I was probably more inspired by what I was seeing out the window. Recently I've kind of made the push to stay home more and, just kind of like plug into my community and my family. And so I think that's kind of shifted what I'm writing about.
Yeah. What do you have next for us that you want to play?
So this is a song that I actually wrote about my parents. My first album, Sodbusters, was about my ancestors and coming to this part of the country and homesteading and, you know, oh, how hard it was. And this is a song in a similar fashion, except it takes place in 1975 when, right after they were married. It's kind of about the first year of their marriage. My dad was kind of building up his dairy herd and they were living in town at the time. And my mom was saving every penny and she bought this new electric stove. And that's important in the song because, my dad came home one day and informed her that, he had bought a farm and would she like to go see it? And so he brought her out to the farm and, the house that they were going to live in didn't have electricity or running water or any of the conveniences that were mostly around in 1975. So,
surprise,
yeah, this song is about that house and their first year of marriage there.
Drifts into the hills, and I can hardly stand it. And we too poor to burn these candles, and sleep claims you as soon as it's dark. You leave me lay here with my regrets compounding my body sore, my belly round and broken tiles, wallpaper peeling, water spots across the ceiling, not enough for me, not enough for me. Drifts of snow form in the kitchen, not a stove or pot to piss in, not enough for me, not enough. These walls sliding down the faded pattern with all thought of leaving bitter tears mixed with the mud. I'm pulling out weeds around young trees, the only roots that anchor me to these broken water spots across the ceiling, not enough for me, not enough for me. Drifts of snow form in the kitchen, not a stove or pot to piss in, not enough for me, not enough for me. Wind so loud, the baby's crying, not a prayer. Not enough.
Thank you.
Something I really admire about you as an artist is how you take kind of your own family legends and turn them into something that I think almost anyone can relate to. I know I have that feeling with your song Sodbusters about the wife along for the journey, finding the place to set up and feeling that loneliness. Tell us a little bit more about that story you're singing, Not Enough. So how does this play into
legend?
Well,
I should preface it by saying that they're still together. So, you know, they made it. They made it through. I think a little bit more backstory behind it is that my mom grew up on a really beautiful and picturesque farm in northeastern South Dakota, right outside of Marvin in the hills, and you know, with a creek running through it and orchards, and it's just like amazing. And the place that I grew up, I think is pretty great. But when my parents moved there, you know, there were hardly any trees. There was just this one building that was the oldest house from homesteading days that was still standing. You know, people weren't really living, you know.
Yeah.
Of course there's different situations, but everybody felt bad for them, and where it was bringing them like carpets and different things to make it more insulated. And you know, my mom remembers the crickets that would come up through the floor and be underneath the carpet, and then you would walk across them. So I'm sure
add a nice texture to the floor.
Yeah, and I think everybody probably has a story like that in their past of roughing it in some way. And so yeah, it is kind of universal.
Yeah,
it wasn't that bad. I'm sure it was fine. Mm-hmm. They made it through.
Right, Jamie, what does it mean for you as a homegrown South Dakotan to be part of this inaugural season at the Levitt?
Oh, it's such an honor. It's exciting. It's exciting that this has come to Sioux Falls. You know, of all the cities across the country, it's so cool that it's here, and to be included it feels amazing. Because you know, there's so many great talents in this community and statewide. And to be featured on this first season it's really exciting. It's exciting to be part of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So what do you want to play for us next?
So I'm going to play you a tune that it's not all that new, but it's about the drive between Sturgis and Pier, Highway 34. It's my favorite drive across the state, favorite part of the landscape, I think. It's called the Cheyenne River Bottoms.
The contours of this country do not fool. You get a road that stretches straight in front of you. Seems Highway 34 could drive me straight into the afterlife. So when I'm at home or away, when I'm in that middle space, troubles, leave my troubles if I got them. In the Cheyenne River bottoms, I'll run from silence to escape my noise. Fill up my mouth with anything but a voice. Like I don't wanna hear what my heart's been saying. Mine's been preaching, has been raising. So when I'm not home or away, when I'm in that middle space, leave my troubles if I got them. In the Cheyenne River bottoms, what if I get older and I just can't take this toil? I can't drive around and sing nobody joy. What if my heart gets bitter and my hands get stiff and I just can't take the half of living? So when I'm not home or away, when I'm in that middle space, leave my troubles if I got them. In the Cheyenne River bottom.
That's Jamie Lynn, recorded live in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios. Quartet Davis out of Oberlin, Ohio, embraces and merges various genres in order to stretch the boundaries of traditional chamber music. The group features violinists Molly Tucker and Camille Vogley Howes, violist Emily Edelstein, and South Dakota's own Carl Henry on cello. They joined us in the Sioux Falls studios for original music, Irish tunes, and the jazz standard, Time After Time.
After time. to be.
That's Quartet Davis recorded live in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios. If you'd like to hear the full conversations of any of our In the Moment segments, go to listen.sdpb.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Connect with me on Instagram, SDPBInTheMoment. And you can find video of many of our musical guests on the SDPB Music Facebook page. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. Thanks to Jackie Hendry for her support this week on In the Moment. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you.